Chapter 39. Marissa. Marissa has experienced the sensation of absolute dread and fear only a few times before. It happened during two of her pregnancies when her doctor's face fell while administering her sonograms, and another time when she momentarily took her eyes off Bennett at a county fair and he was swallowed up by the crowd until she located him 15 minutes later at the petting zoo. This afternoon, when Matthew suggested she take a nap, her mind had been too fractured to quiet. Instead, she'd reached for her laptop resting on the nightstand. The Natalie-Polly connection was haunting her, and she needed to get to the bottom of it. She'd plugged Polly's name into the search engine, along with Natalie's, but nothing had come up. So she'd added the name of the real estate company where Natalie worked. Still nothing. She'd stared at the computer screen for another minute and had been about to shut the lid, but then her fingers had begun moving again, trembling as they'd typed in the name of another woman who has been haunting her, her old best friend, Tina Lennox. She wasn't sure what she was looking for exactly. What new information could there be to see? No baby announcement or employee of the month recognition. There would be no wedding photograph, not even a mention of a high school graduation. Tina's life ended before it could really begin. The first few items that appeared were familiar to Marissa, a couple of old Associated Press stories and a few longer ones by the Baltimore Sun. Marissa had clicked on Tina's yearbook photo, the one all the newspapers ran, and stared at it for a long time. For the photo, Tina had worn the yellow sweater that she and Marissa had decided was the prettiest one Tina owned, and her hair was curled. Then Marissa noticed a few new mentions of Tina had appeared. At least, they were new to Marissa. Local man recants admission of murder of Tina Lennox. Former high school English teacher Marvin Miller claims police coerced a false confession. That article was from 4 years ago. In another one, dated 9 months earlier, on the anniversary of Tina's death, Miller repeated his claims of innocence. "I've spent half my life sitting in a cell while the real killer walks free," he was quoted as saying. Marissa had stared at the screen, her hand over her mouth, feeling nausea rise in her throat. If their English teacher hadn't killed Tina, then who had? It had been a struggle to get through dinner and Bennett's bedtime routine, knowing this reckoning was finally coming. She'd tried to act normally, but more than once she'd caught Matthew studying her with a puzzled expression. Now Marissa stands looking through the double glass doors leading from their family room to the backyard, to where Matthew stands by the fire in the stone hearth. It's a cool, starlit evening, and Matthew has brought out a blanket and bottle of good wine. Bennett is sound asleep in his race car bed, his thumb covered with a fresh bandage and his dinosaur diorama nearly finished. The scene is set for a quiet, romantic night, until Marissa throws a grenade into it. She slides open the door and steps onto the patio. Her husband is tending the flames, using a poker to arrange the logs. The firelight playing across his face conjures an image of another long-ago evening by a bonfire. Not that she needs the reminder.
"There you are."
Matthew puts aside the iron poker and sits down, patting the cushion next to him on the settee. Marissa walks toward him as he reaches for the white burgundy and twists the corkscrew before pulling it out with his strong fingers. He pours them each a glass.
"Cheers."
"Cheers." She takes a tiny sip. She notices that on the eve of their anniversary, he has selected their wedding crystal. She's so cold again, despite her fleece leggings and top and the heat of the fire. She feels as if she hasn't been able to get warm since this all began. Matthew reaches for the blanket, tucking it over her legs.
"You okay?"
Marissa makes a non-committal noise. "Can I ask you something?" Matthew looks calm. He has no idea what's coming.
"Of course."
She takes a deep breath and speaks the question that has the potential to unravel everything. "Why did you lie for Skip all those years ago?" Matthew sets down his glass and turns to face her, as if he recognizes the importance of this moment.
"Because it looked bad for him, and I knew he didn't kill Tina,"
Matthew finally answers.
You and I know Skip sometimes went to work on his boat at night when he was taking clients fishing early the next morning. But if the police knew he was out there alone, near the spot where Tina was killed, they might not have believed him. He was about to go to college on a scholarship. Even if he was cleared later, that cloud of suspicion could have cost him everything.
Marissa nods, remembering the scratch Tina had inflicted on Skip's arm. You were such a good friend to him, she whispers. The false alibi had seemed harmless when Marissa first heard about it from Matthew shortly after they started dating.
Skip was scared. The police were questioning everyone. He came to my house to ask my dad for advice, but my dad was in the city. I knew he hadn't done it, so I told him to just say he'd been with me at home watching a movie that night. My mom covered for him, too. She trusted me when I told her Skip wouldn't hurt anyone.
The lie stopped seeming harmless when Marissa learned about that open window in Matthew's office and about the English teacher recanting his confession. The fire makes a loud popping sound and Marissa flinches, but Matthew doesn't even glance at it. He's staring intently at her.
Why are you bringing this up now?
Marissa's mouth is so dry she needs another sip of wine. I Googled the case this afternoon. Did you know our English teacher claimed the police leaned on him so hard he gave a false confession? Matthew reaches for her hand and begins to massage it.
Sweetheart, ask any man in prison if he's innocent. They're all going to say yes.
How well do we really know Skip anymore? We've only seen him a few dozen times over the past 20 years. He lived across the country until last summer. Matthew's fingers stop moving.
What are you saying?
Marissa begins to shiver. This reminds her of her first confession in Avery's office when she sat shaking from a combination of chill and fear. Then Matthew hadn't responded to her discomfort. Now he wraps an arm around her. She leans into his warm, hard body and inhales his woodsy scent, trying not to think about how it could be for the last time. Then she pulls back to face him. I have to tell Matthew the truth, she reminds herself. And not only because we can't have a real marriage without honesty. Her simple lie has spread and morphed, like an invisible virus that sickens everyone it touches. And like a virus, the lie could turn lethal. It would be one thing if Skip's behavior had affected only Marissa. She could have thrown away the roses and note and soup and lived with the pressure and guilt as a kind of penance. But if Skip is the one behind the vicious attack on Matthew and the apparent break-in this morning, she hates to think like this, but who else could it be? Then his escalation is downright terrifying. She recalls a line she once read. You can never truly know what is inside another person's heart or head. Perhaps Avery has been guiding me toward this moment all along, Marissa thinks. This could be the ultimate test. If Marissa tells Matthew the truth and he forgives her, they really could start to heal. And if he doesn't, well, it is far more important to protect Matthew and Bennett than to protect her marriage. Skip has been acting so strangely lately, she begins.
Yeah, it was kind of weird that he stopped by uninvited last night and then dropped off all that soup.
Matthew shrugs. It's more than that. This is so hard for me to say. But I think Skip could be behind the other things that have been happening lately. Can Matthew feel her leg trembling against his? She swears she can perceive the shift in his energy. He must sense the grenade is in her hand.
Why would you think that, Marissa?
Matthew's tone is even and measured, the way it sounds when he's conducting a difficult talk with a concerned client. Those roses. I called the florist the next day. The Venmo account was at Pier 1234. There's that long pier near where Skip and I grew up. He used to love fishing off it. And the note you and Polly found? Ray, the homeless man who hangs out by Coco, told me someone paid him to deliver it. The same man also gave Ray a pair of gloves. Gloves I know belonged to Skip. Matthew stands up and reaches for the poker. He jabs at the fire. A thick wave of smoke drifts toward Marissa, making her feel briefly dizzy as she inhales it. Matthew, she takes another sip of wine for courage. I lied to you. I didn't sleep with a guy from the gym. It was Skip. Matthew is perfectly still for an endless moment. Then he slowly turns to face her, the poker still gripped in his hand. Half of his face is in the darkness, the other half illuminated by the flickering firelight, making him appear both familiar and like a stranger. Just like Skip looked on the night she first kissed him. Matthew doesn't speak. He stares at her as if he is peering deep into her soul.
The first time I kissed you, it was like glimpsing the ocean for the first time. All these years later, I still feel the same way.
Her husband will never feel that way about her again. Tears spill down her cheeks.
Matthew, please say something. I'm so sorry.
Matthew sets down the poker. He sinks back into his seat and stares straight ahead as if he's in shock.
You and Skip,
he whispers.
Are you kidding me? How long has it been going on?
It only happened once, I swear.
You've been lying to me this whole time.
Matthew's voice is preternaturally calm and soft. To Marissa, it has the feel of the trembles that precede an earthquake.
I didn't know what to do. I thought if I told you, you'd leave me, and I couldn't bear that. But I should have. You deserved to know.
I can't get my mind around this. Skip was in our house last night, Marissa. We all sat around talking about old times, and all the while, you and he...
Matthew reaches for his glass and drains the wine.
Does Avery know about all this?
Marissa hesitates. Will it make it better or worse for Matthew when he hears the answer?
She does, yes.
With a swift, powerful motion, he hurls the empty crystal against the stone fireplace. She flinches as it shatters into a dozen pieces, shards cascading everywhere.
Everybody was in on it but me. You all think I'm a fucking fool.
Marissa shakes her head.
No, I'm the fool, Matthew. I ruined everything. You're the only one I want.
Yet the evidence doesn't support that.
Matthew is back in control, his sharp legal mind countering whatever she says.
I told Skip it won't ever happen again. I begged him to leave us alone, but...
But Skip won't accept that?
Matthew is looking straight ahead as if he can't bear the sight of her.
It seems that way,
Marissa whispers. In a way, she's grateful she can't see the fury and disgust that must be filling Matthew's eyes.
I'll do anything to...
He abruptly stands up. Without a word, he begins heading toward the house. She knows exactly what will happen next. He'll pack a suitcase and stay at a hotel. There will be no anniversary celebration tomorrow. There will be no more anniversaries at all. She watches as he reaches the glass doors. But instead of pulling them open, he turns around and walks back to her. She is prepared for him to yell or tell her to move out. But when he gets closer, she can see his eyes are wet. She has only seen her husband cry once when his mother died. Marissa feels as if something is breaking inside of her, too.
Are there any more secrets?
Of all the hundreds of questions Matthew has asked her throughout their lifetime together, this is the most important one, the one she must get right. She shakes her head.
That was the last one.
Matthew nods, and in that moment, Marissa feels time shudder to a stop. Matthew looks at the house again, as if weighing his options. Then he looks back at her. She waits, afraid to even breathe.
I thought it was over,
Matthew finally says.
But I can't let go of you.
Chapter 40. Avery. I settle into a comfortable rhythm as I jog along Rock Creek Drive. Beside me, Romeo easily keeps pace. It's our first real run since his stitches dissolved, and he seems to crave the exercise as much as I do. It's not merely a physical release I'm seeking. Something about the steady, repetitive motion of my feet along a familiar path tends to free up my mind, and right now I desperately need clarity. Marissa phoned me earlier this morning while I was drinking coffee and reading the Sunday papers, letting me know she'd finally told Matthew the truth about Skip. He still wants to try. Her voice was filled with wonder. He says he can't let me go. It's not that simple, I'd told her. We've got a lot of work to do. Of course. We'll be there tomorrow night. Session 8, I'd thought to myself. The test. I have one in mind, but I may change it up based on what I learned today. I'd asked to speak to Matthew, but she'd told me he was in the shower and would phone later. It has been 2 hours, and I'm still waiting for that call. Just as I think this, I'm nearly jerked off my feet. Romeo, no! I pull on his leash to draw him back. The squirrel that caught his attention scampers across our path and climbs a tree. I wince and rub my shoulder with my free hand, then resume running, passing a pair of women who are walking together along the path. Usually by this point in my process, I've identified my client's issues and have a treatment plan well underway. I think back to the notes I jotted on my yellow pad, beneath Matthew's and Marissa's names during our first session. Marissa's confession, infidelity. Probable root cause, emotional distance. If my progress was being judged solely by the quality of the bishop's relationship, I could view this case as an emerging success. Their marriage appears healthier now than it did when they first walked through my door. Appearances. I'd also written down that word during our initial visit and underlined it twice. Now I mentally add to it, appearances lie. Nothing about the bishops or the people around them is straightforward. The dirt trail veers sharply uphill. My legs begin to burn and my lungs feel tight, but I force myself to maintain my pace, knowing I'll reach the crest and the downhill soon. Beside me, Romeo is still running easily, looking at me every now and then as if to make sure I'm keeping up. I reach the halfway point of my run, which is marked by a fallen tree, its intricate root system exposed. I've warmed up, so I stop to unzip my fleece jacket and adjust one of my earbuds, which keeps slipping out. I've seen a half dozen people on this trail, but no one is around right now. A breeze rustles the trees, and I inhale crisp air. Ready to head back? Romeo seems agreeable, so we turn and begin to retrace our route. A minute later, my phone buzzes in the side pocket of my leggings. I slow down to see who it is, then hit the button to accept the call. Hey, Matthew. I stop again and try to catch my breath. How are you? How am I? It sounds as if I'm on speakerphone. Perhaps he's phoning me from his car. I wait for him to continue. I want to hear Matthew's version of the evening. Completely pissed off, like I've been sucker punched. It's a terrible betrayal. Even if on some level Matthew suspected it was Skip, to have it confirmed must be devastating. And I apologize for being complicit in it. You're the one I'm the least pissed off at, Matthew exhales loudly. Marissa obviously fucked up royally. She shouldn't ever have let Skip in that night. It's going to take me a while to get over that. But these past few weeks, I've done a lot of soul-searching, and one thing I know for sure is that I want to stay married to Marissa. I can't help it. I love my wife. How do you plan to deal with Skip? I want to beat the crap out of him, but I'm just going to call him and tell him I know, and not to come near me or my wife again, or I'll kill him. I get it. I lean forward to stretch one of my calves, which is tightening up. I told Marissa I didn't want to know a single detail about what happened that night. I don't want that picture in my head. Matthew hesitates. Honestly, I think she's relieved Skip will be out of our lives. I think she's a little scared of him now. All the stuff he's done, he could be violent. Behind me, I hear the crack of a stick breaking. I spin around. The trail is empty. We can look into a restraining order if he does anything else, I tell Matthew. But I hope it doesn't come to that. I'm still taking Marissa out on the boat later today. Skip's not going to ruin that for us. It's not going to be the anniversary celebration I wanted, but I don't know, maybe it can be a new beginning. It can be anything you want it to be. Okay. I guess we'll see you tomorrow night. Maybe you should have that tequila ready. I laugh and promise I will. When we hang up, I adjust my earbuds again and resume running. I seem to be alone in the woods, but I'm prepared. I've got Mace on my keychain and I can hear anyone coming. Because appearances lie, I'm not a carefree jogger listening to a playlist. There's never been any music playing through my earphones. Romeo begins to bark and tug on his leash again, pulling me forward. We round a corner and I spot a woman power walking ahead of me. Romeo and I pass her, and then a few minutes later, two bicyclists whip by me. The woods that briefly felt menacing seem safe again. Romeo and I reach the end of the trail and exit. My car is parked where it always is when I do these Sunday runs, along a stretch of Western Avenue. A man is leaning against it, clearly waiting for me. It's a terrible spot for an ambush. Not only is this a busy road, but plenty of people are around. Still, I reach for my mace, ready to fight to protect myself and my dog. I'm sick of being threatened and followed. If it's one of Acelia's henchmen, I'm going to blast him with mace, kick him between the legs, and call the cops. But it isn't. It's Skip. I take a few more steps toward him, ready to tell him off. Then I look down at Skip's hands and gasp. It's cold out, and he's wearing gloves. Blue leather gloves.
Chapter 41. Marissa. The traditional anniversary gift for 12 years is silk or linen. Marissa hadn't been able to find anything inspiring along those lines, so her present to Matthew is a vintage Rolex. She'd ordered it weeks ago and had thought about having it engraved with the message, "Every minute I love you more." However, getting it inscribed proved more challenging than she'd expected, so she planned to give it to him unadorned. She'd intended to wrap it earlier today, but hasn't had a moment alone. Even though Matthew slept in the elephant room again, he woke early and showered in their bathroom. By the time Bennett padded downstairs in his PJs, Marissa and Matthew were in the kitchen drinking coffee. Things weren't right between them yet, but Matthew had agreed to try, and that felt like the best anniversary gift he could have given her. He seemed to have something else up his sleeve, though. After they'd eaten lunch, Matthew helped Bennett pack an overnight bag and was currently taking their son for an unprecedented school night sleepover at Charlie's. Marissa had felt a sharp pang when Bennett hugged her goodbye. She was gripped again by the yearning to be near her son, keeping her eyes on him at all times. But she didn't let on. Bennett had only been on two sleepovers in his life, and even though both were at Charlie's house, Bennett was still a little nervous. "Don't forget to feed Sam," he'd said, chewing on a thumbnail. "I won't," she'd smiled brightly at Bennett. "I'll pick you up after school tomorrow." By then, she'd hopefully have hired a new assistant and given Polly notice, and Skip would be out of their lives. Instead of being filled with a sense of peace, her unease intensifies when Matthew and Bennett leave. She keeps busy tidying the kitchen and loading the dishwasher with their plates from lunch, then removing the watch from her hiding place in the garage and bringing it into the kitchen to wrap. She's folding down the last corner of the package when the scotch tape in the dispenser runs out. There's more tape in her makeshift office upstairs, but a closer roll is likely in Matthew's study. She leaves her gift on the kitchen island and walks into the room, the hardwood floors cool against her bare feet. Across the room, the window by Matthew's cherished Picasso sketch is firmly shut. She averts her gaze. She won't let thoughts of Skip intrude today. There's a letter opener, Matthew's laptop, and a pencil holder on his desk, along with a silver-framed family photo, but no tape. Marissa walks around behind the desk and pulls open the top drawer. Like everything in Matthew's office, it's well organized, with scissors, envelopes, paper clips, and a stapler in neat sections. The tape is toward the back. She pulls the drawer out a little farther and sees another object next to the tape. A woven white rope. She stares at it in confusion, even though she knows exactly what it is. Bennett's missing Cub Scout rope.
What's it doing hidden away here? She pulls it out and stares at it. It's tied in an intricate knot that resembles a figure eight. It's called a sailor's knot. She knows because she grew up on the water, and even though she never learned to make them, she's seen them 100 times. Bennett wasn't practicing sailor's knots, though. He doesn't even know how to form them. He was working on square knots. Her skin prickles. She hears the sound of Matthew's car pulling into the driveway and quickly pulls off a piece of tape, putting back the roll along with the rope and shutting the drawer. She hurries into the kitchen and finishes wrapping the gift, sliding it into her handbag by the time Matthew has unlocked the door. He steps into the kitchen. He's wearing a black jacket and dark jeans, and his expression is grim. Then he sees her and smiles.
It's just the two of us now.
For some reason, her stomach clenches. It's because of everything that happened last night, she tells herself. I should get changed so we can go. She desperately needs a minute alone.
There's no rush.
Matthew walks around the island to stand next to her, taking off his jacket. He's wearing a light blue Oxford, one that Marissa bought him because it complements the color of his eyes.
Come, sit down. There's something I need to tell you about.
She doesn't want to sit, but she acquiesces. Matthew, however, remains standing, setting his jacket down on the stool next to Marissa's. He's close to her. She feels penned in.
I just spoke to Skip. I told him I know what happened between the two of you and that he needs to stay away from us.
How did he take it? She manages to ask.
He apologized. He seemed to understand. But he's been acting so unhinged lately, I don't think we can count on this being the end of it.
An image of Skip flashes into Marissa's mind. Skip at 17, gently cleaning away the blood on the back of Marissa's hand from the oyster shell cut.
I'm not hurting you, am I?
He'd asked. She would never see Skip again, never hear his voice. A deep sense of loss sweeps through her. Matthew is staring at her.
Everything okay?
She nods because it should be, but it isn't. Matthew is so close she feels as if she is inhaling the breath he exhales. Her lungs are growing tight. An almost overpowering sense of claustrophobia grips her as Matthew reaches out and strokes her hair. Oh, I just remembered. Marissa's voice sounds strangled. She clears her throat. I need to call Charlie's mom to make sure Bennett turns in the permission slip tomorrow for his field trip. Matthew's hand dips down lower and he begins to massage her back, his fingers digging into a painful knot in her right shoulder.
I already told her.
Matthew's fingers are too strong. It hurts. She winces and pulls away. What Matthew said makes no sense. She's the one who filled out the permission slip and tucked it in the pocket of Bennett's backpack. She wasn't even aware that Matthew knew about the field trip. You did? Matthew responds with a question of his own.
Why are you so tense, sweetie?
She can't stop seeing that white rope in his desk drawer. If Matthew would just back off, she could try to make sense of the puzzle. Then he finally does move away, and she gulps in air. He walks around to the other side of the island and pulls out a bottle from their wine rack.
I thought we could have a drink before we leave.
Sounds nice. I'll get the glasses. Marissa starts to get up, but Matthew waves her away. He's already taking them out of a cabinet. Before she can do anything, he's back beside her, pressing in even closer than before, his legs against hers. He pours them each a glass. She reaches for hers with a trembling hand. The last thing she wants right now is alcohol. She has to keep a clear head. Matthew clinks his glass against hers.
To my beautiful wife.
His words sound false, as if he's reciting lines. He stares at her as if trying to gauge her reactions to his toast. She feels an overwhelming desire to push Matthew away so she can finally get off this bar stool. She takes a small sip. Matthew is still standing. She has to crane her neck to look up at him. He's smiling broadly. Given the news she delivered last night, something seems off. He's too happy, too carefree, too perfect.
I almost forgot.
He moves away from her again, and she sucks in another gulp of fresh air. Why is it hard for her to breathe when her husband is near? She doesn't know how she's going to get through the rest of the afternoon and evening with him. That white length of rope. She last saw it in Skip's hands on the night they slept together. He was absently toying with it while they spoke. Then he set it down on the end table, right before he leaned in to kiss her. After Skip left, Marissa had hand-washed and dried the wine glasses they'd used, returning them to the cabinet. She'd buried the empty bottle of Malbec Skip had brought deep in the recycling bin. She'd tossed out the uneaten nuts from the little serving bowl, rinsed the bowl, and put the tin of mixed nuts back in the pantry. She'd fluffed all the cushions on the couch. She'd erased the evidence. Had she left the little white rope on the side table? Possibly. It had seemed so innocuous. Her pulse is pounding in her ears, making it difficult to think. She sets down her wine glass. Matthew has gotten something out of the pantry and is back by her side. He's holding a tin of mixed nuts. He pulls off the top and selects a Brazil nut, offering it to her. She shakes her head. She fears she'll choke on it. He pops it in his own mouth.
Mmm.
The kitchen is so quiet, she can hear him crunching. He leans in and brushes a strand of hair off her face. She instinctively flinches.
How's your wine?
It's good. She forces herself to take another small sip. Then another idea seizes her and she blurts out, If we start drinking this early, tomorrow might be a little rough. Let me quickly call Polly and let her know I might be late. Inquisitive Polly will pick up on something in Marissa's voice. Marissa can stay on the phone with her for a few minutes, coming up with some fabricated tasks she needs Polly to take care of in the morning. Marissa would just feel better if she could speak to someone right now and let the person know she's in the kitchen of her house with her husband, alone. But Matthew's next words drain every ounce of hope from her body.
I already told Polly you'd come in a little late. I called her right after I dropped off Bennett. You need to relax, Marissa. I've taken care of everything.
You called Polly? This makes no sense. Matthew has only met her new assistant twice, maybe three times tops. She doesn't even think Matthew knows Polly's last name. So how does he have Polly's cell phone number? Matthew smiles.
Polly knows how worried I've been about you. And she's been worried too. All those hang-ups, that crazy note.
He reaches into the back pocket of his jeans and brings out a white piece of paper folded into quarters. As he smooths it out, Marissa sees it's been taped back together, like a completed jigsaw puzzle. She releases a small, high sound. The last time she saw that note, it was in pieces in the trash can at Coco. She'd assumed it was gone forever. Polly must have fished it out of the garbage and reassembled it before giving it to Matthew. Have her assistant and her husband been meeting in secret?
I asked Polly to look after you.
Matthew murmurs.
Kind of be my eyes and ears when I'm not around. To help me keep you protected. She took my request very seriously. You know Polly, she's nothing if not overly conscientious. I suggested she keep a log of all the hang-ups and other incidents, since someone is clearly obsessed with you. Just in case.
Marissa begins to tremble. The kitchen has two exits, the door to the garage and the opening that leads to the hallway and front door. A knife is in the block by the sink. Her car keys are in her purse, which is sitting on the end of the island a few feet away. Her cell phone is upstairs in the charger on her nightstand. She catalogs all of this information instinctually. The wine bottle is within reach on the island. The glass looks thick and substantial, and the bottle is nearly full. Her hand creeps out toward it while her eyes remain fixed on Matthew.
I'll get that.
He scoops it up.
I made sure to buy a case of your new favorite.
Matthew picks up the bottle and begins to slowly turn it around to display the label. She doesn't need to see it. She already knows it is the same wine Skip brought over. Her husband no longer looks merely joyful. He seems filled with a triumphant glee. You can never truly know what is inside another person's heart or head, Marissa thinks wildly. What was Matthew's first clue? Maybe the rope? Matthew is highly attuned to details. If Skip left it in this nautical knot and Matthew saw it when he got home from his trip, his mind would have begun to whirl. She'd buried the empty bottle of Malbec in the recycling bin, but Matthew had been the one to take the bin out to the curb. He'd know she would never drink an entire bottle of wine alone. And those mixed nuts that Matthew just offered her. Marissa never ate them because they were so salty, and Bennett didn't like nuts, but Matthew loved them. He often snacked on a handful or two at night. Would he have noticed the tin had been nearly emptied on an evening when he'd been out of town? Yes, he would have. Dread fills her. How long have you known? She whispers.
Forever. Skip has always had a piece of your heart.
Matthew's lip curls.
But in terms of you fucking him? I confirmed it the following night when you went into the shower and left your cell phone in your purse. You were clever enough to delete any text exchanges between the two of you, but you didn't think to erase the record of Skip's incoming call. He phoned you at 8:20 p.m. on the night I was out of town, and you two talked for 47 seconds. Not long enough for a proper catch-up with an old friend, but more than enough time to invite one over.
Matthew suddenly lifts his head, as if a noise has caught his attention. Then he looks back at Marissa and says, in a tone so conversational it's chilling,
"You didn't think I was really going to take you away for an anniversary celebration, did you? It was so much fun to tell Skip about all my romantic plans for an overnight boat trip, though."
Marissa begins to tremble. Matthew has been creating fictional scene after fictional scene, and she believed every one of them. He was never the unaware, wronged husband. That was an illusion, a gifted con artist's sleight of hand. Blackness crowds her field of vision, and she grows lightheaded. She is on the verge of passing out. She fights the sensation with everything she has, grabbing the counter to steady herself.
"If you knew all along, why did you pretend?" she manages to ask.
"I've always been good at the long game, especially when it comes to Skip. He thinks you're pregnant, by the way. I told him so when I invited him over the other night for a drink. The look on your face when he dropped off all that chicken soup."
Matthew laughs and takes a deep sip of his wine. Bile rises in Marissa's throat. She knew she and her husband had drifted apart, but she never suspected he'd been a stranger to her all along. Marissa's eyes dart to the note on the kitchen island. The threat has been staring her in the face in black and white. But the words belong to Matthew, not Skip.
"You wrote this."
Matthew smiles.
"Clever, huh?"
She's reeling from the layers of deception. Why would Matthew want to make it appear as if Skip wrote that message? Matthew picks up the note and folds it again before tucking it into his back pocket.
"I even made sure to buy a pair of those blue gloves for Ray. I figured you'd see them sooner or later. I also picked up a new pair of gloves for myself."
He pulls a pair of thin, black leather gloves from his jacket pocket and slips them on. This action makes no sense, yet it fills her with a bone-chilling terror. The kitchen is warm. Why would Matthew need gloves? Her head is swimming. She struggles to think, to make sense of things. She leans back in her chair as far away from Matthew as possible. Matthew counters her move, leaning in closer. He seems to be relishing her fear and confusion.
"Can I give you a bit of constructive criticism, babe? You're a terrible actress. The look on your face when you thought Skip had broken in here and dropped those lifesavers."
Matthew runs a finger down the side of her cheek. The cool leather of his glove against her skin makes her shudder.
"Tell me the truth,"
he whispers.
"Did you wonder if Skip hired someone to attack me? You did, didn't you? But anyone can inflict bruises. You can even do it to yourself. All you need is determination and a brick. You can even pretend to pass out to make it seem like your injuries are more serious."
She can't breathe. How easily she'd been fooled by all the fake evidence Matthew had planted. She believed Skip was a threat, but the threat lives inside her home. An explosive noise erupts from the front of the house. It's the sound of fists pounding against the front door.
"Marissa!"
Skip's yell is muffled, but it's unmistakably him. The doorbell rings several times in furious succession, then the pounding resumes. Skip has come to save her. She twists her head to look in the direction of the door. Matthew is still penning her in, but if she kicks out, she might be able to get past him. She can run to the door and fling it open. Matthew reaches for his jacket, fumbling with it for a moment, and when she glances at him again, her heart stutters. He's holding a gun. She tries to scream, but her vocal cords seize up. There is utter silence for a moment. Then, on the side of the house where Matthew's office is located, Marissa hears a window shattering. Matthew cocks his head toward the sound. He looks perplexed.
Seems like your obsessive lover has resorted to breaking in. Skip must be really panicked to forget I gave him the code to the back door a while ago. Our little reunion was supposed to happen right here, but that's okay. We can move it to another room.
What is her husband saying? Before she can try to make sense of it, he makes a movement with his thumb, and she realizes he has taken off the safety. His index finger is curled around the trigger of the shiny black weapon. They don't keep a gun in the house. Matthew must have been planning this for some time. Matthew lifts the pistol a bit higher so that Marissa is at eye level with the little round tunnel the bullet will fly through. All she can see is that tiny circle. It's as if the whole world has narrowed to its circumference.
I could call the police, or I suppose I could try and stop him.
But instead of heading toward the noise, Matthew continues pointing the gun at Marissa.
No one would blame me for shooting the man who killed my wife.
Marissa's eyes widen. It's far too late, but she sees everything clearly now. He's going to kill her, frame Skip, then murder Skip, claiming it was self-defense. Her husband is a master illusionist. Their happy life together has been a mirage. She has no idea how he lured Skip here, but it doesn't matter. Marissa cheated on her husband and thought he forgave her. But he didn't. She only knew half of their story. Matthew has been operating from a different script.
I need you to stand up, Marissa.
When she doesn't move, Matthew reaches for her arm and yanks it roughly, pulling her to her feet. She gasps in pain. Her legs are so rubbery, she nearly falls to the floor.
I've wanted to hurt you ever since I found out you fucked our friend in my house.
Matthew hisses in her ear. Please, she begs. Bennett!
Let's go greet Skip. You first.
He steps behind her, and when she doesn't move, digs the gun into her shoulder blade. She rises and walks out of the kitchen, down the hallway toward the study, then stumbles. She's going to be sick. The thought of leaving her precious little boy is too much. Matthew will be viewed as the heroic, grieving widower. He'll have full custody of Bennett. She retches, then starts to cry.
Get a grip, Marissa.
Matthew barks, jabbing her again with the cold metal until she resumes walking. At the threshold of Matthew's office, she sees Skip pulling himself through the broken window. He's got his coat draped over the bottom to protect himself from the sharp shards, and his upper body is through the jagged hole while his lower body dangles outside the house. Blood drips down from a cut on his forehead. His eyes widen as Marissa and Matthew step into the room. Skip looks frantic. He's too late. Matthew will shoot them both. The final scene he is directing will be complete. He even has witnesses in place who will testify to Skip's obsession and to Matthew's seeming devotion to Marissa, Polly and Avery. Marissa hears the noise of a distant siren, but if the police are coming, they'll be too late as well.
Walk toward the window,
Matthew instructs her.
I'll shoot you now if you don't.
Skip shouts.
I'll kill you if you hurt her. Actually, it's going to be the other way around,
Matthew replies. Marissa keeps her eyes locked on Skip. There's nowhere to run. She might be able to grab the letter opener from Matthew's desk, but he will surely fire his gun before she has a chance to wound him. She takes a step towards Skip, then another, as if she were walking down a gangplank. Skip stops moving.
Look, Matthew, it was my fault, okay?
Skip's voice is pleading.
Not hers. You don't have to do this. Keep walking,
Matthew orders. Marissa takes another step. Skip's words tumble out.
Marissa picked you, not me. Sure she did,
Matthew snaps.
Just like my dad prefers me to you, just like Tina did too.
Marissa freezes. She can't take another step.
Things didn't end up so well for Tina, either,
Matthew continues.
Do you know she thought it was you chasing after her when she was sitting on the pier alone that night? She looked so disappointed when she turned around and saw me. But not for long.
Three things happen as Matthew speaks those horrible words. Skip abruptly drops backward through the open window, vanishing. Matthew shoves Marissa roughly to the floor and runs toward the window. And a gunshot explodes, the sound so loud and powerful it seems to reverberate through Marissa's soul.
Chapter 42. Avery. The blue leather gloves aren't my only clue, but the second I see them on Skip's hands, everything else clicks into place. There is no way Skip could have given his gloves to Ray and still be wearing them himself. But someone else could easily have purchased a near-identical pair and passed them to Ray along with the anonymous note. That same person could have ordered the yellow roses from Bloom, made the phone hang-ups, and even orchestrated the attack on Matthew. I think I know who it is, but I need one question answered to be certain. Never before has so much hinged on the test. The night you and Marissa slept together, where did it happen? Skip looks bewildered. Her house, your place, your car, where?
Her living room. But listen, I came looking for you because there's something else I need to talk to you about. It isn't about Matthew or Marissa. It's about Matthew's father.
I don't hear anything he says after that. I'm recalling the words of a different man.
Marissa shouldn't have ever let Skip in that night.
Only a few minutes ago, Matthew told me he hadn't wanted to hear any details about the night Marissa and Skip slept together. So how did he know that one?
Matthew has been setting you up, I tell Skip.
At that moment, Skip's phone rings with an incoming call. Skip turns around the screen to show me.
It's him.
Answer it. I can't hear what Matthew is saying, but as I watch Skip's expression transform from anger into a kind of primal terror, I act on instinct. I pull Romeo into the back seat of my car, jump into the driver's seat, and start my engine, while Skip leaps into the passenger side.
He's going to hurt her, Skip shouts. I'm calling 911.
I'm already making a U-turn, my wheels squealing against the pavement as I head towards the bishop's house. There's no traffic on a Sunday afternoon, and I'll run any red lights we encounter. We're only a couple minutes away. Matthew must know his threat will bring Skip to his door, but he won't expect me to be there too. Matthew had a long time to plan this, but I've got the element of surprise on my side. I've got something else, too. As we race toward the bishop's house, I steer with one hand and reach across Skip to unlock the glove compartment of my car with the other. I take out my fully loaded .38 pistol and set it on my lap.
I know the code for the back door. Give me the gun.
Skip is leaning forward, one hand on the door handle, ready to leap out the moment we get there.
No,
I instinctively say. He'll be expecting you to go in that way. Then I tell Skip what we're going to do. By the time we pull up by the curb down the street from the bishop's house, Skip has his jacket off. He leaps out before my car comes to a stop and sprints diagonally to the front door, banging on it and yelling Marissa's name. He's creating a diversion. If Matthew is watching out a window, his eyes will be on Skip. I lock Romeo in my car, then quickly survey the terrain. The bishops have neighbors on both sides. To their left is a house with a manicured lawn and two cars parked in the driveway. The one on the right is surrounded by trees and thick bushes. I opt for that one, hoping the cover of the foliage will camouflage my movements. By the time Skip is breaking a window at the side of the house, as I told him to, I've arrived at the back door. I punch in the code Skip gave me, SAMB, for the name of Bennett's pet gecko, praying no one has changed it recently. The light on the lock switches from red to green. I'm in. The kitchen is empty, but I hear the sound of retching, then Matthew barking,
"Get a grip, Marissa."
They're in the hallway, heading toward the noise Skip is making. I step into the hallway a half dozen feet behind them. My gun is raised. It's difficult to shoot a moving target, so I aim for center mass, envisioning a bullseye on the back of Matthew's light blue shirt. We move almost in unison toward Matthew's office, my footsteps light and nearly soundless in my running shoes. I'm like a ghost, creeping unseen behind the bishops. As I step into the office, I hear the distant siren of a police car, then see Skip struggling to pull himself through the window.
"Walk toward the window," Matthew instructs Marissa. "I'll shoot you now if you don't."
"I'll kill you if you hurt her,"
Skip is shouting.
"Actually, it's going to be the other way around."
I scan the scene, knowing I've only got a few seconds to act. Matthew is going to shoot Marissa just as Skip clears the window and heaves himself into the room. Skip will lunge at Matthew, and Matthew will shoot him too. Then Skip stops moving. He has spotted me.
"Look, Matthew, it was my fault, okay? Not hers. You don't have to do this. Keep walking."
Marissa steps forward. Skip is trying to distract Matthew while my gun remains fixed on the invisible bullseye. I can't shoot Matthew, though. Marissa is directly in front of him. My bullet would probably tear through him and hit her.
"Marissa picked you, not me."
Skip's desperate, playing to Matthew's ego. Skip must have done the mental math, and he knows there is no way he can get to Marissa in time.
"Sure she did," Matthew replies sarcastically. "Just like my dad prefers me to you. Just like Tina did, too."
Marissa stops moving.
"Things didn't end up so well for Tina, either."
Matthew's tone is pure evil.
"Do you know she thought it was you chasing after her when she was sitting on the pier alone that night? She looked so disappointed when she turned around and saw me. But not for long."
"You sick bastard," I think. Matthew raises his gun slightly, and I know this is it, the moment he's been planning ever since he discovered his wife and good friend betrayed him. Marissa is completely silent. She must be in shock. Skip is still too far away to help. I've only got one possible move. I flatten out my left hand and gesture in a swift, downward motion, the same one Skip taught me on the night he met Romeo. Down. Skip's eyes widen briefly, then he gets it. He flings himself backward and disappears. Matthew leaps forward, grabbing Marissa and shoving her to the ground. Then he runs toward the window, leading with his gun. The instant Marissa is clear, I pull the trigger. A tremendous boom echoes through the room. Matthew collapses to the ground, dropping his weapon. Before I even realize I'm doing it, I run over to him and kick the gun away. A widening bloodstain blooms across Matthew's chest, and he makes a faint, gurgling sound. His eyes flutter, then roll back in his head. Marissa is still lying on the floor, her arms curled around her head and her eyes squeezed shut, as if she's waiting for the next gunshot. My eyes flit from Matthew's body to Skip hurling himself through the window. When Skip reaches Marissa an instant later, he wraps his arms tightly around her. I step closer to Matthew and nudge him with the toe of my sneaker. He doesn't appear to be breathing anymore. I move over to Marissa and Skip, but keep my gun trained on Matthew. He seems to be dead, but he has tricked me before. He's not going to do it again. Marissa finally opens her eyes and stares up at me. She whispers,
"Tell me it isn't real."
"It is," I say gently. "And it's also going to be okay."
Chapter 43. Marissa. Time is a chameleon. It's ever-changing, cannily adapting to circumstances. It stretches out some tiny moments for an eternity. Then it shifts course and swallows up whole days, years even, as if they never existed. It's as slippery and elusive as water running through the cracks in a tightly cupped hand. It has been 8 days since Matthew's death. A stretch of time that felt endless, yet far too short, because it brought Marissa here, to Monday, her scheduled re-entry point into the world. Marissa thought she could do this. She imagined Coco would be a refuge again. But all the scented candles and gorgeous objects and shiny fixtures provide her no peace. They're just beautiful things. They have no importance at all. Marissa has spent the morning desperately bargaining with time, wishing for the clock to spin forward so she can pick up Bennett. Other than when Marissa needed to give statements to the police, the two of them have not been apart since Matthew died. Marissa sleeps curled next to Bennett in a double bed. For the first days at her parents' home on the Eastern Shore, and since then in a guest room at Skip's townhouse. She takes Bennett to see a child psychologist and gives him ice cream every night, as if the sweet treat were a balm. When Avery asked to come over to meet with her, Marissa scheduled their talk for after Bennett's bedtime and kept his doorway within view the entire time. Now, her son's absence is like a missing limb. The bell over Coco's door jingles as two customers enter. Marissa and Polly have been busier than ever this morning, but most of the people coming in aren't shoppers. They're gawkers, thrilled by their proximity to danger. Marissa can already tell these women have come to her store to collect a story to serve up to their friends. They're not looking for new coasters or robes. They're looking for her. "I've got this," Polly announces, and she marches up to the women while Marissa slips into the back room. Marissa can hear Polly deflecting the women's nosy questions. "If you're not here to buy anything, we cordially ask that you leave." Polly steps briskly into the back room a moment later. "Just some looky-loos. I got rid of them." "Thank you," Marissa replies quietly. Polly reaches out to touch Marissa's shoulder, then withdraws her hand. Marissa can tell Polly has been gearing herself up for this conversation all morning.
"If I had known, I never would have told Matthew anything."
Marissa nods. "How did it all start?"
Polly's chin trembles and her eyes grow wet. "Matthew came by the store one afternoon right after I began working here. You'd gone to pick up Bennett from school. He introduced himself and told me you were trying to get pregnant and that you'd had some fertility issues. He asked me to look after you, to make sure you were eating enough and that you didn't lift any heavy boxes."
All the offers of tea and muffins and salads. Polly's distress when Marissa tried to pick up a box of pillows. It makes sense now.
"Matthew paid me to," Polly blurts. "He insisted. He'd come by when you weren't here, usually at closing time. He'd give me some cash and ask how you were doing. I thought it was so sweet that he loved you so much."
Marissa should be upset, but it's such a small betrayal in the grand scheme of things.
"After we found that creepy note, we started talking more frequently. I'm such a dummy. He really made me believe he was trying to protect you, Marissa."
"I believed him too. It's okay, Polly. Truly." Polly twists her hands together.
"Well, if there's anything I can do, anything at all."
Polly hangs her head and begins to walk away. Marissa doesn't feel as if she has much to give. She needs to save it all for her son. But she can offer Polly this one small thing.
"Actually," she calls out, "I would really love it if you could make me a cup of tea."
Polly spins around and wipes away the last of her tears.
"Coming right up."
After Polly serves her the hot chai and goes back to the front of the store, Marissa sips it and stares into space. Learning more about the extent of Matthew's depravity only increases her desire to be with Bennett. Her son is the antidote to Matthew's poison. Marissa keeps recalling how Bennett had looked walking up the front steps of Rolling Hills this morning, holding his dinosaur diorama in both hands, his big backpack resting on his small shoulders. Would the other kids stare at him or ask him upsetting questions, or worse? Marissa has spoken to the principal and Joan in the front office and Mrs. Tanaka. They all promised to look out for him. But children can be vicious, and teachers couldn't be there all the time. Someone could taunt Bennett in the hallways or in the bathroom. "Your dad tried to kill your mom," or "It's a good thing your dad is dead." It's too much for Bennett's little shoulders to bear. She imagines him sitting alone in the lunchroom or leaning against a tree at recess to hide his tears, and Marissa bends over, wrapping her arms around her waist, aching for her son. She'd been so foolish to imagine they could step back into their old lives as easily as slipping on a soft pair of shoes. A week, a month, a year, there would never be enough time to recover.
She's about to call the school to check in when she hears the jingle of the bell over the door again, then Polly saying Marissa is busy right now. Leave us alone, Marissa wants to cry. She curls into a tighter curve, wishing she could disappear. I only need to talk to her for a minute. The loud voice is close and familiar. When Marissa opens her eyes, she sees Natalie standing on the threshold to the back room in her sky-high heels and leather leggings, her shiny black hair flowing. This is a restricted area, Polly practically shouts. She's tugging on Natalie's sleeve, trying to pull her away. Jesus, let go of my blouse. It's Stella McCartney. It's fine, Polly. Marissa lifts her head wearily. Why fight it? Whatever Natalie has come to say, she's clearly determined to say it. Polly shoots a final angry look at Natalie, then moves away. Nice guard dog you've got, Natalie rolls her eyes. I guess I'm to blame for that. I heard you were looking for an assistant, and I knew my boss wanted to help Polly because he's close to her dad, so I told him she should apply here. Matthew thought it was best if you didn't know about my involvement, but I couldn't resist rubbing it in the other day. Sorry about that. But you have to admit, you and I haven't always had the easiest relationship. Marissa blinks. Is that what you came to tell me? Natalie brushes at her sleeve as if she's erasing Polly's touch. No, this is. I remember how worried I was about Veronica when her father left me. I get that this is a million times worse. Marissa looks at Natalie a little more closely and finally says, Thank you. So don't worry about Bennett. I'm on it. Marissa is bewildered. You're on it? Natalie looks at her levelly. All of us moms are. We've got him, Marissa. Then Natalie turns on her heel and saunters back out. 3 o'clock takes forever to arrive. Marissa is in the passenger seat of Skip's Tesla, waiting for the students to come streaming out of Rolling Hills. Skip is behind the wheel. He went to work today, too, but he left early to pick up Marissa and Bennett. Together, they will drive back to his townhouse. She doesn't know how long they will remain there, but Marissa can't ever imagine wanting to go back to the house she shared with Matthew. For the moment, at least, the townhouse is their home. Skip took care of everything to make them feel comfortable there. He'd picked up Sam and his cage, along with clothing and personal items for Bennett and Marissa, so they'd be surrounded by familiar things. He cooks for them, salmon on the grill or simple pasta dishes, and talks easily with Bennett about the habits of hummingbirds and the mysteries of the solar system. At night, after Bennett falls asleep, Skip's solid presence is a comfort to Marissa. Sometimes she talks to him about Tina, sharing some of the good memories she has of their friendship. They also discuss Matthew, reassembling the image of the man they both thought they knew.
Matthew knew how I felt about you,
Skip told her.
But when he offered me an alibi the night Tina was killed, he convinced me I owed it to him to let him have a shot with you.
Skip had shaken his head.
Turns out I was the one giving him an alibi. I always thought he was a jerk. But I had no idea he was evil.
As the days go by, they talk less about Matthew. More often lately, they've simply been watching television together or reading side by side in the living room. Skip has been the best friend she could imagine. Nothing more than a friend, though. Mourn your marriage,
or what you thought your marriage was,
Avery had said when they'd met for their 9th session.
But don't ever forget the possibilities life holds for you.
Marissa can't think that far ahead. But as she unfastens her seatbelt and Skip comes around to open her car door, she does allow herself to recall this. What did you say back when we were teenagers and you told Matthew how you felt about me? She'd asked Skip just last night. He didn't blush or look down. He'd simply replied,
I told him the first time I kissed you, it was like the first time I saw the ocean.
Skip hadn't asked why she'd burst into tears. He'd just hugged her. At 3 o'clock sharp, the big double doors to the school open. Marissa scans the faces of the students coming down the front steps. A pack of rowdy boys are in the lead, with a teacher loudly admonishing them to walk, not run. Then she sees Bennett. He's all alone. Her heart leaps into her throat. She wants to race to him and throw her arms around him. Then she hears a boy call out, "Bennett, wait!" It's his best friend, Charlie. Then another boy joins them, Lance, the baseball player who wears his sister's hand-me-down pink cleats. They're flanking Bennett, one on either side. Bennett comes closer, and Marissa studies his face. His eyes are clear, his skin tone is even. There are no signs at all he has been crying. She feels the tightness around her heart ease. "Bye, Bennett," a boy calls from a dozen yards away. Then a small girl wearing a chic little leopard print jacket calls Bennett's name, waving. "See you tomorrow." It's Veronica, Natalie's daughter. As the crowd of kids disperses, Marissa sees Natalie a few yards away, leaning against her shiny Jaguar, surrounded by her usual hangers-on. But Natalie isn't talking to them. Natalie is watching Bennett carefully, too. Natalie seems to feel Marissa's gaze. She turns and meets Marissa's eyes. "Someday soon," Marissa vows, "she will call Natalie and suggest they get together for a cup of coffee or a glass of wine." But for now, she settles for mouthing, "Thank you." When Bennett finally arrives at the car, he is smiling.
Chapter 44, Avery. You might think, watching them, that they're an ordinary mother, son, and grandfather enjoying a beautiful spring afternoon at the park. But the Bishops, like the rest of us, are far more complicated than they appear. I slowly walk toward them, along the trail that winds through the Candy Cane City Park, pausing every now and then to let Romeo sniff a dandelion or, and this bit of his progress delights me, wag his stubby tail at another dog. Romeo is healing from his traumas, but he still bears scars. We all do. Some of ours are just more visible than others. Marissa puts an arm around her son's shoulders and bends down to kiss the top of his head. I wonder if Bennett is recounting the story of his rocket getting stuck in the tree and his dad lifting him up to retrieve it. Bennett chose this spot when Marissa asked where he wanted to go to remember his father. Matthew hadn't spent much time with his son, but at least Bennett has a few good memories. "Bennett doesn't seem to be grieving much," Marissa had said to me last night at Skip's townhouse when I'd seen her for our ninth session, reconciliation. For Marissa, like most of my clients, this means reconciling her new reality with the loss of her former life. Because if I've done my job right, my clients are in a completely different place, emotionally and often physically, by this point in the process. I told her what I tell all of my clients who are struggling with loss. Grief is a shapeshifter. It defies logic, sneaking up on you when you least expect it and leaving you empty-handed and hollowed out when you go searching for it. "Bennett knows you're here for him, and that's the most important thing," I'd advised Marissa. "Answer any question he has, but don't feel the need to make sense of it all for him now." She'd nodded and reached for a tissue. "Do you know what some people used to call us? The golden couple." "I do know," I'd thought as I pictured Marissa and Matthew gliding into my office for their first session. They'd almost convinced me too. Then I'd put a hand on her shoulder while she'd cried. Her tears were mostly for her son, but they were also for herself, because even though Matthew wasn't ever the man Marissa tried to pretend he was, grief breaks all the rules. Marissa and I still have one final session left. Promises. The 10th meeting is when my clients embrace their new futures. I suggested we schedule it whenever she is ready. I also told her there was no expiration date. But I have the feeling Marissa will reach out to me before the end of the year. I also have a pretty good idea of who will be in her future, but Marissa needs to find her own way to him. "Come on, Romeo," I say now, giving his leash a little tug. Marissa hadn't wanted to hold a memorial service for Matthew. Given that detectives are now investigating whether Matthew was responsible for Tina's murder in addition to trying to kill Marissa and Skip, any public event would have turned into a media spectacle. So she planned this little private one at the park. Marissa knows I'm coming, but her father-in-law, Chris, does not. I'm counting on the element of surprise to continue to serve me well. On Bennett's other side, Chris leans over to say something to his grandson. Chris looks like a doting grandpa. He appears to be the kind of guy who would stop and help if you got a flat tire or would stuff a pillow under his shirt to play Santa for a holiday party. Until you see his eyes. Matthew inherited his icy blue eyes from his father. I've put together a timeline since Matthew died, casting back in my memory in between my questions to Skip, fitting in the pieces until the narrative finally flows. It began with Finley, of course. But the next person who entered my life was Chris, not Skip, and not Marissa and Matthew. I just hadn't seen him coming. Like his son, Chris is an invisible architect of destruction. He has been behind the curtain all along, wreaking havoc. I now know that Chris works in the shadows. Many of his clients seek him out for the kind of services they can't dirty their own hands with. Men like Chris have always been around. They protect the interests of the biggest players in the most powerful cities in the world. They're the jury fixers, the eyes in the sky at billion-dollar casinos, the dirty political operatives who take down national candidates. Chris's name doesn't appear on Acelia's list of employees, but he's one of their most valued assets. Shortly after I called in my tip to the FDA, I burst onto Chris's radar. Chris began looking into my life, searching out potential entry points. He found out I was single, then he asked Skip to befriend me. That meeting at the Matisse bar was no accident. Skip didn't know many details then. He just thought he was doing a favor for the man he'd known since he was a teenager, the man who'd helped him get a scholarship to Dartmouth and had given him a start in business. But after a few dates, Skip explained to me, he defied Chris. I liked and respected you too much to try and trick you into giving me information about your clients. The rest of what Skip had already told me was true. He'd begun to suspect Matthew could be dangerous, so he sent Marissa the Post article about me. He hoped I could help her see who her husband really was and break free from her marriage. At least one part of Skip's desperate plan worked. Marissa did make an appointment to see me. He just hadn't counted on her bringing Matthew along. Skip had no idea that Chris was increasing the pressure on me on behalf of Vasilia, sending his henchmen to move my Synthroid medication onto my bureau, follow me to my doctor's office, and even pose as a new client. I was looking at your appointment calendar that night when you caught me coming out of your office, Skip confessed. But it was only to see if you were meeting with Marissa. I swear I had nothing else to do with what Chris did to you. When I got over being pissed off at Skip, I told him I was flattered by the faith he'd placed in me. Now I walk a little farther down the path at Candy Cane City, enjoying the feel of the sun warming my face and the laughter of a group of kids tossing around a frisbee. Marissa catches sight of me and waves me over. Avery, you made it. Her father-in-law whips around at the sound of my name. Chris's poker face is impressive. He must need one in his line of work. His only other reaction to me is a tightening around his lips. I've taken precautions to prepare for whatever he might do next. I did kill his son, after all, and now I know exactly who Chris is, whom he works for, and how he's connected to my life in ways that have nothing at all to do with his family. But Chris merely nods at me. I exhale and slide my hand out of my coat pocket. Marissa turns to Bennett. Sweetie, this is my friend, Ms. Chambers. Can I pet your dog? Bennett asks. Sure, his name is Romeo. Bennett holds out his small hand to let Romeo sniff him.
His tongue tickles.
Do you want to take him for a walk? I suggest. Maybe your mom can help. Marissa nods. She's in on my plan. I hand Romeo's leash to Bennett. Romeo ambles off with the two of them, looking back a few times to make sure I'm not going anywhere. When they are out of hearing distance, I say simply, "I'm sorry for your loss." Chris shakes his head.
"I lost my son when he was 16 and came home with blood on his shirt the night that girl was murdered. My wife went to bed early that night, but Matthew told her to say he and Skip watched a movie with her, so she did. She always covered for him."
Chris knew all along what his son was capable of. I take another good look at Chris, finally putting a face to the dark menace that has been looming over me ever since I blew the whistle on Acelia. Chris knows where I live and where I keep my prescription medication. He knows what kind of car I drive and where my doctor's office is located. But Chris still doesn't know the singular piece of information that led him to infiltrate my life in the first place. The name of the client who told me about the faulty Rivenux drug trials. He's never going to know that. I've spent the past few days collecting more information on Chris than he'll ever be able to amass on me. With Skip's help, it has been easy. I know who many of Chris's other secret clients are. I know where he lives, what keeps him up at night. I stare at Chris for a long moment.
"Skip told you," Chris finally says. "I can tell."
I nod. Chris spreads out his hands.
"It was only business."
"I understand your clients are important to you," I tell Chris as he watches me with his flat eyes. "Mine are important to me, too. I know a lot about them and their families. For example, I know Bennett is allergic to shellfish. I know the parking lot at Bennett's school gets busy at pickup time and can be dangerous if the children aren't carefully monitored. I know random criminals break into private homes in expensive neighborhoods like the one Bennett lives in. And I know that in another year or two, Bennett will be old enough to take the bus to school all by himself." The most important bit of information I've gathered about Chris is his weak spot, his grandson. Bennett is the only person in the entire world that Chris loves. I would never hurt a child. But I'm good at bluffing. So, nothing is going to happen to my clients or their families, right? I lean closer to Chris. Any of my clients. He continues to stare at me. In the distance, Bennett's sweet, high voice calls out, "Grandpa, the ice cream truck is here. Do you want a strawberry shortcake?"
"That would be great," Chris shouts back, still staring at me.
Then he breaks our gaze and replies,
"Understood."
I'm not done with him yet. "Someone contacted an insurance company and leveled a charge against me." I shake my head as if I'm bewildered by the very idea of it. "Apparently, they got an anonymous tip that my husband's death wasn't due to natural causes." Chris folds his arms.
"What do you want me to do about it?"
"It's not a challenge, it's a question." I smile. "Do what you do best. Make the problem go away, Chris." An hour later, I unlock my front door and tap in the code for my security system, then remove Romeo's leash and give him a pat on the back. I don't bother resetting my alarm. I'm sure I'll need it again someday, but for now, the threat against me is gone. "Go get your bunny." My fierce-looking dog's favorite new toy is a fluffy stuffed rabbit. Instead of chewing it, Romeo has taken to carrying it around tenderly and sleeping curled around it at night. Love is an eternal mystery, I guess. There's a lot I should do today. My voicemail is full. I've gotten media requests from as far away as Hong Kong and offers from film producers and messages from Oprah, Hoda Kotb, Jimmy Kimmel, and dozens of others who want an exclusive interview. Maverick ex-therapist kills client. That headline does sound pretty irresistible. I could keep turning down the interview requests, or put in the order for the dinner I'm having delivered to eat with Lana tonight, or answer emails from a surge of new prospective clients. DC is a peculiar city. My notoriety has only made me more in demand. Instead, I slip off my shoes and walk upstairs. I turn right at the top of the hallway, heading in the opposite direction from my bedroom. I've been planning this short journey for a while now. It's surprising how long it has taken me to get here. I open the door and walk into Lana's old bedroom, the one with bird feeders outside the windows and photographs of Paul, Lana, and me on the walls. The old Crosley turntable is still in one corner of the room. I lift the lid and see the last record I ever played for Paul. Miles Davis, Out of Nowhere. Paul used to argue that the composition is Davis's true masterpiece. Most people prefer Kind of Blue, with the legendary John Coltrane on the sax, but the first time Paul ever invited me into his home, he played this record. I blow the dust off the vinyl and set down the needle, listening to it bump and scratch before it settles in. The title song is the one we danced to at our wedding. There aren't any lyrics. The music is pure, magnificent emotion. I look at the space that once held Paul's hospital bed, remembering my husband's final words to me. He'd mouthed them through dry, cracked lips, but they were unmistakable. I'm ready. I'd been amassing morphine in preparation for the moment. I always do my research. I knew exactly how much it would take and how to insert it into his IV. When the needle was empty, I'd climbed into bed with Paul and held him in my arms while the morphine seeped into his veins. He was gone by the time the record finished playing. Now I step into the center of the room and close my eyes and remember. I don't see Paul as he was during his final months, bone thin and weak, a shadow of his former self, a man I'd stopped loving long ago. I see the husband who completely captivated me, spinning me across the dance floor in my long white dress while our guests applauded, his dark eyes promising me everything.
God, I love you,
he'd whispered in my ear. Then he dipped me down low and scooped me back up into the air. The space Paul inhabited is empty. It's still hard for me to wrap my mind around that. Maybe it always will be. I sink down onto the floor and wrap my arms around my knees. Miles Davis's trumpet sings to me while I cry. Grief isn't linear. It isn't logical. There's no structure or civility to it. It grabs you when you least expect it and digs in its nails until you succumb. So I give in to it until the final notes fade away. Then I get to my feet again. I look around the room, imagining it not as it was, but as it will be, with a guest bed in one corner and a pretty rug on the floor and a potted tree by the window. Or maybe I'll transform it into an exercise room with a yoga mat and treadmill and wall-mounted TV. The space has so many possibilities. I walk back out again, this time leaving the door wide open. We hope you've enjoyed The Golden Couple, a Macmillan audio production for St. Martin's Press. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield, directed by Kimberly M. Wetherell, recorded and engineered by Laura Darrell and Michael Bader. Text copyright 2022 by Greer Hendricks and Sarah Pekkanen. Production copyright 2022 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.